Welcome to News Talk, and this is D.G. Martin. My guest is a former director of the Central Intelligence Agency and my friend James Woolsey. Jim, thanks for taking time from your busy, can I just say you're a bi-coastal person?
I suppose getting close to that, yeah. About half time in California these days.
Jim is spending time at his Washington area farm where there are no corn-fed cows. I read this in the...
That's certainly true.
And then are you sort of a scholar in residence at...
At Hoover at Stanford, I'm the Annenberg Visiting Fellow for the year, and I guess that's right. I'm working on an article. I'm going to some seminars at George Shultz Chairs on Energy and having a great time. And then I'm spending part-time at a venture capital fund in Silicon Valley, Vantage Point, where I'm a venture partner working on renewable energy issues.
Jim, just briefly, and I want you to describe this, but I'm going to just to set it up for our friends in Chapel Hill. Your walk and interesting tightrope between your two political perspectives that put you in sort of in one camp of friends on some days and in another camp of friends in other days.
I'd like to get friends together. Some people have called me a greenocon, I guess. What I am is an old-fashioned Scoop Jackson, now I guess I'd say Joe Lieberman Democrat, who kind of leans liberal on domestic things and conservative on defense and foreign policy issues. I've been working hard on both the security and the climate change issues related to energy. I've got, David, a chapter in a Brookings book that's just been published, a collection of a bunch of authors. And
can you say climatic cataclysm?
Yeah, it ain't easy. Climatic cataclysm. But my chapter is called A Partnership Deal, and it consists in part of a dialogue between a tree hugger and a hawk to come up with an energy policy for the U.S. The tree hugger is the ghost of John Muir, and the hawk is the ghost of George S. Patton.
It's really interesting. You got another the chapter.
That's called A Partnership Deal.
But then you got a subtitle.
Malignant and Malevolent Threat.
See, you were the smart guy in law school. I can't even say those words. I
mean, Malignant, as in cancer.
Yeah, I can say malignant. I can't say
malevolent. You can say malevolent.
I just can't do it. But what it sets up, and I want to let me throw in one more fact in addition to your experience working for President Clinton in the Central Intelligence Agency, and you've got a lot of experience. You worked in the Department of Navy. Mm-hmm. So you've got the military background. And as you said, a Scoop Jackson, Joe Lieberman, Democrat in those days. But in the past political campaign, you worked for John McCain,
yes,
both on security issues and on energy issues.
Yes.
And this, it's kind of a setup in terms of the your chapter in the book that I hope we'll talk about, that you and Joe Lieberman just don't find a very comfortable place totally comfortable place in either partisan party right now because of the way we kind of have divided up on these issues. But basically, and I'm going to characterize this and then you can correct me, but basically you'd be a hawk on defense matters and on security matters, and you would be a tree-hugging liberal on energy matters and on many environmental issues. Am I close on, or is that just not too rough?
Close enough for government work, yeah.
Well, tell us what talk to us about your thinking. What are you thinking about and what are you worried about on both these matters?
Well, we have to, just focusing on energy for a minute, keep in mind that we need for it to be affordable. We need for it to be clean, I think, not only in local pollution terms, but also in terms of putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and contributing to climate change. And we need for it to be secure. And we have, broadly speaking, two major energy systems in the country. We have transportation, which has a 97% oil monopoly. And OPEC has something close to a monopoly over oil. The top nine countries in the world that export oil, only one, Norway, is a democracy. All the others are dictatorships or autocratic kingdoms, and they get to feeling their oats when oil prices up, like you know, Russia and Venezuela, and they get a little depressed, and that's good for us when oil prices go down. But more importantly, is the fact that oil is funding the other side in this long war against terror that we're involved in. The Saudis put out some of those hideous education materials in the world. They're virtually uniformly somewhere between murderous and genocidal with respect to Shiite Muslims, Jews, homosexuals, and apostates, and massively repressive of everybody else, including particularly women. The other day, a young woman was gang raped in Saudi Arabia by 100 men, and they've sentenced her to death by stoning for adultery. I mean, you can't have a system more rotten than that, short of genocide.
Jim, this you're talking not from the standpoint of some of us might be talking without a lot of information, but in terms of your interest in security matters and your experience as head of the Central Intelligence Agency, you know better than most of us what kinds of reports are credible and which are not. I want to again try to characterize what you're saying and then hope that you'll correct me and supplement it. But basically what you're saying is that the that we wouldn't have need for a war on terror if we weren't funding that war with the way we supply the energy needs in large part for our automobile transportation.
That's right. I mean, every time we pull into a filling station, we ought to turn the rearview mirror a couple of inches and look into our own eyes before we get out to charge the gasoline, because if you want to know who's paying for those madrasas in the West Bank and in Pakistan teaching those little eight-year-old boys to be suicide bombers, when you turn those the rearview mirror a couple of inches and look into your own eyes, now you know who's paying for it.
Well, let me. Can I push you just a little bit on this? Because one of the things that we learn in terms of counterterrorism, counterinsurgency, is that it is not always and not just the funding that gives life to these insurgency and terrorist movements, but there is a lot of commitment and hatred that fires that fires these as well. But and so I'm pushing you to say that. No, that might be right, but if you pulled the plug on the funding, these things would collapse, or they would collapse into insignificance.
I think that's essentially right. Tom Friedman has a great column on Bahrain. He says, what's the first Arab country to run out of oil? Bahrain. What Arab country has a Jewish woman as their ambassador to the United States? Bahrain. What Arab country permits churches and synagogues? Bahrain. What Arab country has a reasonably open and free speech press? Bahrain. There is a lot that is going on in incentives about terrorism and all the rest. But one thing that is pretty clear, I think, is that we are creating a serious problem for ourselves by letting OPEC and the dictatorships of the world have a monopoly over the way we drive. That they are hurting right now because oil is only, it used to be regarded as high, but is only down around $40 a barrel. They'd love to have it up 80, 90, 100. But if they, even at 40, we are borrowing many tens to 100 or to a billion a year just to import oil. And it goes for purposes. Most of it that would not be anything Americans would want. It goes to dictatorships, it goes to autocratic kingdoms, it goes to fund the Wahhabi sect schools around the world. In The Looming Tower, which Lawrence Wright wrote, and I think is the best book on 9/11 and Al-Qaeda, came out 3 or 4 years ago, Wright says that with a little over 1% of the world's Muslims, the Saudis fund about 90% of the world's Islamic institutions, including, so you can be pretty well sure, these schools that I described in the West Bank and in Pakistan that are teaching little boys to be suicide bombers are Saudi-funded.
This is interesting, and it's so, it's a, such a difficult thing, I think, for many Americans to deal with, because we're told on the one hand that the Saudis, Saudi Arabia, is a bulwark of American friendship on the Arab side of the world, along with Egypt and some of the other smaller Gulf states. And now you tell us that Saudi Arabia may appear to be a friend, but based on your experience and knowledge, they're nothing. They're not friends in terms of
what. Well, it's kind of relative. There are some things they help out on. They have a huge feud with the Taliban and al-Qaeda, but it's a little bit like the feud between the Stalinists and the Trotskyites back in the 20s and 30s. It's not that they disagree about fundamentals. It's that they disagree about who should be in charge. So they'll help us, yeah, sometimes catch al-Qaeda members, and we help them. But the religious establishment, the Wahhabis, are responsible for some of these, most all of these things that I've described, such as the stoning of women and so forth. Now, the king, King Abdullah, just 2 days ago appointed a new education minister, and the specialized press that watches these things is saying this is a very good guy who's going to make some very fundamental reforms in Saudi education. Well, good. They're long overdue. Let's see. It's not that there aren't things we can work with the Saudis on. My goodness, we worked hard for three years with the Soviets and Stalin in World War II because we had a more immediate problem, Hitler. We can work with the Saudis on some things, and maybe they will make some reforms, and that would help. That oil which does not come to the world market from Saudi Arabia, almost all of it is coming from other dictatorships and autocratic kingdoms.
We're visiting with James Woolsey, the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, about his concern about the relationship between national security and our energy policy. And when we come back after this break, we'll talk to him a little bit about some of the options that we've got on the energy policy side. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with my friend James Woolsey. Jim is a former director of the Central Intelligence Agency. He is now living part-time on his farm in Maryland near his you're still an executive with Booz Allen, a consultant.
I'm an advisor to them. I'm mainly a partner in a venture capital fund in California, Vantage Point, and a fellow at the Hoover Institution these days at Stanford.
So we're visiting with you from your California residence.
Actually, I surprised you. I'm now back in the East Coast. I'm in my Maryland farm.
By golly. Well, that sounds even better. Can't keep up. I mean, these spies, you just don't know where they're going to be. Jim, we talked a little bit about about your view that the funds that I'm going to spend after I finish talking to you, when I stop at the gas station and fill up my relatively efficient but still guzzler automobile with petroleum, a lot of that money is going to go directly or indirectly but fairly quickly into the hands of people who are educating young people in the Muslim world to hate me.
Yep.
and to take action against me, and that therefore I'm looking for the guilty parties. I'm funding the war on terror, really two sides of it, I guess,
yep,
as a taxpayer and then as a petroleum buyer. All right, now, Jim, the other thing, we've talked about your walk in both sides of the political spectrum as an advisor to Senator McCain in his presidential campaign on energy and security matters. Let's talk about what you would be telling, what you told Senator McCain during the campaign and what you would be telling us today about what our options are on the energy side and what the country ought to be doing in the next few years.
Well, on this transportation side of energy, I think moving away from oil as quickly as possible, as quickly as we can do it affordably, is the right course. And there are two things to emphasize. One is coming up on the inside track is the really promising thing, and that's electricity. I've had my regular Prius, converted to be a plug-in with an added 5 kilowatt-hour battery, and I can charge it overnight and drive for about 45 or 50 miles on 55 cents worth of electricity.
Let me just interrupt you. I want to put this in perspective. That means that if you have a 20-mile commute back and forth,
yep,
you can go the whole month without putting any more petroleum in your car.
Right. 3/4 of Americans drive less than 40 miles a day. So three-quarters of a plug-in hybrid that has a 40-mile range on its overnight electricity charge, three-quarters of those on any given day are all electric cars, essentially. But you have liquid fuel in the tank, so that if you have to go visit sick Aunt Agatha, you know, across the dismal swamp, you don't run out like you would with your cell phone and not have any place to plug it in.
Well, I want you to go back to your spiel, but let me just interrupt one more time to emphasize this point, and that is that with current available technology, that is that's available to the automobile manufacturers, we could eliminate three-quarters of our automobile-related petroleum consumption.
It's a little bit less than that because some people, when they drive considerably more than 40 miles a day, and after 40, 45 miles on a car like mine, they're just a regular hybrid, so they're getting 45 miles a gallon. But on three-quarters of the days, it's a way
to...
Basically, three-quarters of American car driving days are less than 40 miles.
So my translation of it might be exaggerated a little bit.
The thing that's happening is that the batteries are getting better and better. And whatever you've kind of heard about it, that there's the big problems, batteries and so forth, that they keep fixing it. It's sort of like looking at the $2,000 cell phone I got for my wife back in the 1980s. It weighed 6 pounds and
right.
came in its own little suitcase. And everybody said, well, that's kind of crazy. And I said, yeah, I know it is, but it's kind of interesting. I think they may get cheaper. And, you know, and year by year they did. Well, the batteries aren't improving quite as fast as the Moore's curve, so-called, produced the improvements in microelectronics. But they're moving pretty fast, as are photovoltaics. That is what you can put on your roof in order to generate electricity. I got some of that, those two, just under 4 kilowatts of it, and I can charge some lead acid batteries in my basement. And then if I want to show off, go off grid, throw a switch, let those batteries charge the batteries in my plug-in hybrid overnight, and then drive for about 40 miles on sunlight.
So theoretically, theoretically, many Americans using the technology that you have available off the shelf right now for your car could go for extended period of times on their local commuting transportation without using any oil.
Yes,
without using any energy other than sunlight.
It's expensive to do that right now because the storage, the batteries, the capability of the lead acid gel batteries and so forth to store, it's pretty expensive. But those battery changes are coming along too. There's something called flow batteries, FLOW, which have a lot of extra electrolyte in them, and they're now being used industrially for server farms and to have places where there's which it's really important not to have any interruption in the power supply. But those are coming for the home too within a very few years, and they'll be quite inexpensive. So, today I'm driving at a little more than a penny a mile for the first 40 miles each day, and that's from grid electricity. Gasoline at today's prices is about 4 to 5 cents a mile after, say, a 22-mile gallon car. And it'll be it was much worse than that, of course, last summer. It's 15 to 20 cents a mile when oil was up at nearly $150 a barrel.
Well, now, Jim, you've been thinking about this a long time, and so this question should be easy for you. But what are you've explained to us that where we could be, and what's holding us back from getting the rest of us to where you are very quickly?
This is largely a matter of material science, engineering, and getting up the cost curve on battery manufacturing and on manufacturing of photovoltaic, either cells or thin film for your roof to turn the sunlight into electricity. The basic inventions kind of are done. There's a lot of use in basic research because the big improvements are going to come along through improvements in material science and so forth. But it has some similarity, at least the photovoltaic cells, it has some similarity to the way change has occurred in microelectronics and chips. We used to be a much more elaborate process to build a silicon chip than it is now. This generation of cell phones is a lot more cheaper, or this generation of radios or anything else, than the previous generation, is that that's gotten more efficient. And it's not as fast as the microelectronics improvement. It's not doubling in capacity every 18 months to 2 years, but it's doubling in capacity every 4 or 5 years in terms of efficiency of the batteries and efficiency of solar cells. So the thing that's really interesting about solar and batteries is that they're going the right direction. They're going more efficient and cheaper, whereas much of the rest of energy is going in the wrong direction. And even though right now there are you can build a coal-fired power plant, and if you don't take any carbon out of the atmosphere, you can produce electricity cheaper than you can from your roof, but probably only about twice as cheap. And 3 or 4 years ago, it was four times mm-hmm. cheap. So it's the photovoltaics and the batteries are going to change things a lot. There are a lot of other things that are too. We have a heat pump geothermal system for our house. We got little wind turbines down at the dock to charge battery and raise and lower the boat. There's lots of interesting things that are coming in energy, but I think photovoltaics, sunlight to electricity, and battery improvements are probably the two most important.
We're visiting with James Woolsey, a former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, now an entrepreneur, a visiting scholar, and a passion for the intersection of our countries and our individual energy policy with the war on terror. He and I'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Jim Woolsey is my guest. I'm sorry, Jim Woolsey. I'm supposed to call you James Woolsey.
No, you're not.
Big
That's
deal
fine.
Now. Jim is a longtime friend of mine and a former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, and is visiting with us, as I learned, from his Maryland farm, not from his headquarters on the West Coast, where he's an entrepreneur and visiting scholar, or not, resident scholar now at Hoover. Is that right?
Just for a year, so I guess it's visiting.
I don't know what the deal is, but anyway, doing all kinds of things. His passion apparently now is energy policy. Jim, I want to spend just a minute or two, because I may be getting the wrong impression, because you're giving me all this reassuring stuff about how science is and the incremental improvement of the battery storage devices and the other engineering devices that will help us take sun energy and store it and make our cars so that they can run long distances on battery. This stuff is coming. Don't be impatient with this. Everything's coming. But in reading some of the things that you've written, you show a little bit more impatience about about two things: what government policy ought to be, and what our personal ethics ought to be about energy. And can you put on your hard nose hat again about this?
Well, I think in addition to the automobile side of energy, which we've been talking about, of course, there's the entire question of how do you make electricity. And we make it about 50% from coal now, and the rest a mixture of natural gas, nuclear, and hydro. Sometimes say, if you're using half of it, if coal is producing half of electricity, how can you switch from driving on gasoline to driving on electricity and make any progress? Well, the two reasons. One is, what comes out your tailpipe is so dirty, even with a 50% coal electricity grid, you're making about a 20-25% improvement in your emissions by moving to electricity. But the main thing is that as the grid cleans up and as you move from coal to, say, wind and solar and so forth over the years, it cleans up the cars, too, if you're driving on electricity. And we can make real progress in cleaning up the grid. Part of this, I think, is recognizing what can be done locally. That is, we don't always have to build big power plants, whether those big power plants are coal with carbon capture and sequestration or natural gas or solar or wind, plants in the Southwest or wind farms. We can increasingly do a lot in what's called distributed generation of electricity from our roofs, from small wind turbines locally, et cetera. There are just a lot of developments coming along, and that makes us a good deal more resilient against things like terrorist attacks on the electricity grid, or even what happened in Cleveland in August of 2003 when a tree branch touched a power line, and within 9 seconds, some 50 million people were without electricity, and it had billions of dollars lost in both in eastern Canada and the eastern U.S. from a tree branch touching a power line. You can make yourself more resilient against things like that by a lot of your electricity being generated from renewable sources locally.
Well, Jim, we have all sorts of horror stories that various people, including you, have put in front of us about what the terrorists could do if they were smart enough to jump on it. And one of those that you've described, and you, that it could be something more than just a, or something different from a accidental falling of a tree on a set of wires, that a terrorist with a little bit of sophistication could bring down our electric grid, and that one with real resources, for instance, a small nuclear bomb, a pie in the sky could put us out of business kind of on a sustained basis.
Yeah, the thing about a nuclear weapon and electricity is something called electromagnetic pulse. There's been a national commission on this. It's issued an unclassified summary report that is pretty chilling about how even a primitive nuclear weapon, let's say fired by Hezbollah, given the, let's say, the Iranians develop a nuclear weapon, which I think they're just about to, and they give it just a simple short-range missile without warhead to Hezbollah, and they put it on a fishing boat and launch it up 100 miles above the east coast of the U.S., they can take out an awful lot of the east coast's electronics that way. But they don't even have to do that. Hacking and going around and blowing up electric substations and so forth can be a very serious problem as well. Our electric grid has not been designed for security, and we need to take a number of steps here to improve that. The utilities and the public utility commissions tend not to like to admit that because they're afraid somebody's going to sue them if something happens and they admitted that there's a problem and they haven't fixed it, then they could be in legal trouble. But we have to get national leadership here from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the president, and so forth, to get the industry together and make these improvements in security of the grid.
I'd have to say that that although you didn't write a lot of pages about the grid, your words about it frightened me as much as anything else in terms of our vulnerability as a nation, and led me to think, well, gosh, we've got an interstate highway system that's largely put together as a matter of national policy, and we as users pay taxes for its use. Is it conceivable to talk about having the national government be responsible for that grid system and not just regulate it, but provide the hardware and set it up?
I think it has to be responsible for the security. How much you need to rebuild the grid depends on things like how many wind farms and solar power plants located away from where people are do you need to build, and how many transmission lines and what kind and so forth. But whether you use the existing type of grid or you change its nature somewhat, you got to make it secure. And I think that ought to be our first step, is to take the existing grid and improve its security. And then as we need to add transmission lines to it or change some of its characteristics over time, we can do that.
We're visiting with James Woolsey, former CIA director and now an advocate for a national improvement in terms of our energy policy as a way to improve our security. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Former CIA Director James Woolsey and I are visiting about energy policy. And Jim, we've talked a little bit about the interesting position that you find yourself politically as you call yourself a Scoop Jackson or Joe Lieberman, sort of in the and I don't know where your party loyalties are.
Yeah, well, I'm still a Democrat. I'm kind of a strange one, but I am.
But you, like Senator Lieberman, worked for Senator McCain. And it's funny when you look at it in a way, because it puts you on the security issues, puts you at odds with your friends in the Democratic Party, and on the environmental issues, puts you at odds with not all, but many of your folks on the Republican side. In fact, what I'd like to do is for you to talk about the global warming situation as you do in the things that you've written. Because down here, a lot of my friends who tilt right, they just won't acknowledge that there is here's where they are on this. First of all, they will argue that if there is global warming, it's just part of the regular climate cycle, and that there's been no proof that what man is doing has any significant impact on what's happening. As I read your stuff, you don't go along with that way of thinking. I don't want to call you an alarmist, but you're worried about this, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. And I think the point is that the Earth's climate's been changing for a long time. Ice ages and so forth. And that has not been caused by human beings, because we weren't putting a lot of CO2 into the atmosphere until beginning a couple hundred years ago, coal plants and so forth. So we are, it's certainly reasonable for people to believe that some of what we are seeing with melting Arctic ice and so forth is part of a historic trend, tilting of the Earth's axis, for example, it's occurred many times in history. That doesn't mean that we are not making the problem considerably worse by doubling and then trebling the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. You can almost not find a climatologist, that is somebody, you can find economists, but you can't find people who are trained in climate and are professional and highly regarded climatologists who are not worried about this. They virtually all are. The people who write the books and the articles and give the press conferences and write the think tank papers that say this is no problem, it's very, very, very hard to find a climatologist among them. And I look at it this way. Suppose we are in something like a warming trend, but we're making it worse by doubling and trebling the amount of CO2 going into the atmosphere. You know, if you or I were unlucky enough to have a genetic propensity toward lung cancer, it wouldn't be a smart thing for us to say, well, what the hell, I'll smoke six packs a day. Yeah. We are, I think, making the problem worse by putting all this carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and more importantly than what I think, virtually all distinguished climatologists in the world think that.
What are the so what if the world does get a little bit warmer?
Well, it's not just warmer. My friend Amory Lovins uses the phrase global weirding, which is, I think, probably a better one, or just climate change, because some of these things may make things cooler. For example, if the melting Arctic ice on Greenland puts enough fresh water into the salt water, it can interfere with the operation of the Gulf Stream, and that could cool Europe off rather than warming it up. So it's a complicated set of, I think, effects on weather. I'll give you one example why we probably don't want the overall average to go up. 125,000 years ago, when there were humans of a sort around, the world was 1 degree centigrade on average, warmer approximately than it is now. And sea levels were about 5 meters higher.
Wow. Okay? Now, you know, in North Carolina, if you go very far east from where we are here in Chapel Hill, you get down to the coastal plains where that would make a difference.
16, 17 foot sea level rise would not be good for either North Carolina or New York or Florida or Bangladesh or practically any place. And can we say for sure 1 degree centigrade more is going to do that. No, I don't think so. What we have is a set of judgments about phenomena, some of which occur only relatively rarely, and you get what you're worried about, what the climatologists are worried about, is that you're going to get past a tipping point and aren't going to be able to go back. Most people think in linear terms. They think of things as changing gradually and in a kind of a straight way, whereas scientists often, particularly people who work with climate, are very familiar with things that change exponentially. That is, they get around the corner of a curve and move very sharply, like, say, lily pads growing on a pond. They may seem to be going slowly, but they get to such a point, they go real fast. And that's just an exponential phenomenon. It's common in nature for various reasons, but it's the melting of the West Antarctic ice shelf and of the Greenland ice shelf, I think, probably more than anything else, that has the climatologists worried. And once you get past the tipping point there, there may not be any real going back beyond adding a number of feet or even meters to sea levels.
Well, do some of your friends accuse you of talking like Al Gore? Do you agree? On these issues? Do you agree substantially with the way that Al Gore?
I agree with a lot of his statements. Maybe not absolutely all. The way I look at it, it's more it's less a matter of certainty than it is a matter of insurance. I mean, nobody around here at this farm has ever known lightning to strike right here, but I sure have lightning insurance on the house. I mean, it may be very unlikely, but, Dick Cheney, who I have a high regard for, by the way, said that, you know, with respect to a terrorist getting a nuclear weapon, if there was a 1% chance, we have to treat it as if it's virtually certain and go to general quarters and stop it from happening. Well, I think the same thing's true of climate change. It doesn't mean that we have to tax everybody immediately a huge amount of money if they're burning coal. We got to find the technology to make that coal able to have its carbon dioxide sequestered, or we got to find the technology to lead a transition to solar and wind. And I think we can do that. We've done harder things. We're in the middle of doing not too bad a job of it right now. But I think denying that lightning might strike your house and therefore saying you don't need to spend anything on insurance is not wise.
We're almost out of time, and we haven't talked enough about your chapter in Climatic Cataclysm. Have I said that? I'm getting over my speech impediments. That's going to be published by the Brookings.
Yeah. It's been out for a few months now.
It's available now, and you and a number of other distinguished commentators address the possible cataclysm that we're involved in and make pragmatic suggestions. In your chapter, you set up a dialogue between a George Patton figure, which represents your right-hand side, and a John Muir character who represents your left-wing liberal tree-hugging side. And you have them come to a rough-and-ready accommodation about how to deal with some of these factors without compromising the essentials of their points of view, which I say this is Jim Woolsey talking about himself. And do you have any hope for your friends on both sides of the political spectrum coming to some kind of accommodation like you had John Muir and George Patton come
to?
Yes,
I do. I was testifying before a House committee a few months ago on climate change, and one of the conservative Republican members from California didn't agree with me, and the questions were coming back and forth in my answers. And finally, I said, Congressman, set aside climate change for a minute. You realize that 7 of the 8 things I suggested would also make us more resilient against oil cutoffs and against terrorism? And he said, oh, well, if you do them for that reason, it's fine.
I'm laughing at him, but I'm the same way. You know, I mean,
a lot of people kind of feel, as long as people don't have to lose the argument, if they can work together toward an objective that they believe is important, and they find that there's somebody else working on the same objective, doing the same things, even though they have a somewhat different objective, there's no reason why, you know, as I said, my home state of Oklahoma, in the musical, the farmer and the cowman should be friends.
Yeah, right, right.
Same is true of the tree hugger and the hawk, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, James Woolsey, we appreciate your sharing this, your perspective with folks here in Chapel Hill. And you're, of course, uniquely qualified with feet in both of these camps to help those of us who might be on different sides on some political issues come to accommodation on this critical energy. So keep working, and I hope that you'll come back and visit with us sometime soon.
Great to be with you today.
Thanks to Jim Woolsey, and thanks to all of y'all. I'll be back same time tomorrow.